This is Terry Gibson, Gnostic Cinema, October 8th, 1994, tape 3 of 4.
Let's let Carl talk to us for a second. I'd like to put a little visit our projection for Sophia. From the letters, outer world and God are the two primordial experiences, and the one is as great as the other, and both have 1,000 names. The roots of both are unknown. The psyche mirrors both. It is perhaps the point where they touch. I've been playing with that point all day long. Stefan Holler has lifted from Eleanor Bernstein's, I would say these are Jung's 8 Gnostic. What is the essential elements of a kind of a Jungian Gnosticism? And they're wonderful. The pneumatic element is an organic part of the human psyche. If you think of that Plotinus chart, the pneuma, the collective unconscious, is an essential part of the human. The one is in all of us. That's a element of Jungian dogma, or a creedal statement of faith in the Jungian Gnostic worldview. The pneuma, the breath of God, is in all of us. The Ruach, the breath of the divine, touches all of our lips. The spiritual element carries on an active dialogue with the personal element of our selfhood through the use of symbols. The symbol is what mediates it. Murray writes a lot about Gnostics, and his Gnostic symbols, about how the symbol mediates the divine, and we work with symbol, the living, resonant face of the Imago Dei that's in us. These symbols proceeding from the pneumatic component of the self, of the soul, reveal a path of spiritual or psychological development which can be traced not only backwards towards the past, but this is the important thing about Jung that Freud didn't get into, but forward to a goal in the future. Freud just thought he'd teach you how to clean out the unconscious and teach you good psychic hygiene. One of the things he was upset was Jung had the self, that there was a prospectival. There was an eschaton for all of us. There was a possible destiny of wholeness for all of us that we discovered. Jesus is discovering this film. He discovered one part of his individuation. Well, love's part of it. And he didn't like it, but the axe is another part. And he gets a third. That's revealed to us. But it leads us back to... And Freud didn't like that. You can't get in that spiritual, mystical mumbo. We all have destinies. And there's some Jungians. As I said, there's a school of Jungian thought now that reacts against that kind of classical vision. But I still think it's an essential component that Jungian psychology, when you get into these symbols in the unconscious, it throws us into our destiny, which is a destiny made whole and I think perfects us in love and grace and mercy and compassion after we deal in a realistic way with the darkness and the archons and the evil that's in us. Prior to an arising of gnosis, the human soul is dominated by many blind and foolish powers. Johnny knows that. Can't get out of his struggle. The guard knows it. We all know that. The alienation of consciousness, along with its attendant feelings of forlornness, dread, and homesickness, must be fully experienced before it can be overcome. The makers of the rapture and the makers of Sliver and the makers of Naked knew that. And they wanted us to not turn our eyes from a rich experience, a powerful and sad experience, the forlornness, dread, and homesickness, which is in all of us. Johnny and the guard are homesick. They don't even know where home is. Johnny knows this. What's that wonderful thing he thought about? Stay. That's right. Yes, lots of places to go, mate. But there are very few places to stay. That's at home. That's that yearning for homesickness. Thank you. That gets it. That's the forlornness. The goal of spiritual growth is expressed by images of completion and a whole, which the Gnostics often called the pleroma, fullness, or the anthropos, or primal man and woman, and which Jung called the self. The wholeness of self, which is the end process of spiritual growth, is characterized by all the qualities such as power, value, holiness, which religious systems have attributed to God. And the growth of the soul has as its goal a state of integrated wholeness rather than a condition of moral perfection. And that's a big difference. So I think that's where we're in a crisis globally, I think. Fundamentalism is a threat all over the globe now, I think. Whether it's Islamic or Buddhist or Christian or Jewish fundamentalism, it is a frightened psyche that wants to impose an ego-based moral code on the rest of the world. out of their own kind of need to control. It's kind of sitting in their screen and wanting to control all the psyches of the rest. It's a much different kind of matter than saying integrated wholeness and trusting that we all come from the same unus mundus and it will come uniquely and distinctly to each of us, and trust and rever that unique individuated pattern for each human being on the face of the earth. It takes a lot of guts and trust to let go to that process and not want to impose our control on other people. But that's a profound... And the Gnostics, that's why they were stamped out. They weren't interested in moralism. They weren't interested in an Animal Farm list of rules on the side of the barn. They were interested in creating incubated places for individuation where people each discovered their unique individuality and destiny within community. Their communities were profoundly integrated, but they respected and birthed unique individuations. Fundamentalism cannot respect that. And I think it's one of the biggest curses of modern time. And
didn't Johnny say this thing he was ranting about in the world, you know, in 1999 Wells?
No.
That's a lot of those religions you're referring to are also saying that.
That's right.
So they have to impose their stamp of order on this chaos. It sounds like they think to be saved.
And apparently some people don't go along with it, so what you do is... You handcuff and put a plastic bag over their head and you shoot them and burn them in a barn. It looks like some of those people didn't want to, when they got to the final line, they wanted to leave the community. So that whole thing is very sad, we read about in the paper. Did you see what fundamentalism goes amok? And some people, my guess, wanted to leave and there was no choice anymore. And that's what will happen. You know, that's, my sense is if we don't moderate fundamentalism, we'll incinerate the globe. That's what will destroy us in this experience. You know, in Jung, it's been reported... that he had an apocalyptic... The last dream that he wrote in the Red Book, the last dream he had, was an apocalyptic dream. All the evidence that we have about it is whenever Marie-Louise von Franz has been asked about it on film and off, she defers... apparently she's the one who reputedly has the last dream or knows where it is. And of course the son now's got the Red Book. I spent a whole interesting 6 hours with the only son that Jung had, who's got a lot of the unpublished letters that have got the dark sides of Jung, which a lot of us think needs to be published. And Jung had a huge dark side. He was inappropriate with some women patients. He had a huge dark side that we need to know about. He was a patriarch. I think that healed and changed over time with him in his later years. But he also had a thing with Victor White about this kind of evil and darkness and stuff. They had a correspondence and half of it's missing. And the sun has taken it out of circulation. And it may be for good reason, for the protection of the living and the innocent, but I'm hoping that this stuff reappears and that this reputed dream. But she does say, she's reported that what she'll often defer to when asked about this last vision, she said that last weeks of his life she was with him and he was out on a cane and up at Balingen. And if any of you have seen it up on the old tower up in the upper lake, you know, it's just... In his time, it was kind of wilderness. Now it's become as civilized as our Cascade Mountains. But then it was pretty wild and woolly part of the Zürichsee, up in the upper end of the lake. But he was up there in this crystal clear Swiss winter night, pointing at all the constellations with a cane and saying, you know, they say the possibilities for life as we know it. The biochemists and the paleontologists and anthropologists tell us that the possibility of life as we know it being reproduced in a carbon environment somewhere else, there's millions of possibilities for an Earth-like terrestrial environment in the cosmos. But recently, I've been troubled by the cold and dark and uncomfortable thought that this precious experience of consciousness, as we've come to experience it on this planet, it's only happened here. And if we fail to be a good grail for this kind of sacred experiment, and we incinerate it, it will disappear forever and the cosmos will be lost in one long, cold, dark night. Well, that's a Gnostic understanding of both the preciousness and the possibility and the potential darkness. And I don't think Jung was ever naive about that. And I think that's the tension we hold. We have there's a richness here and there's a potential. I mean, it could, naked could be a sign of where we're all going. A potential end of the experiences we have it. Let's look at an image of a man who I think gets there in a kind of a classic film. Again, the popular audiences didn't like. I had to decide whether I was going to show my favorite film of all time, but I've shown it once before for one of the union groups, so I'm not going to show it today. But I'll tell you, my favorite, if you want to say, everybody says, what's your favorite film? It just pops out of Wim Wenders' Wings of Desire. I don't even have to think about it. It's absolutely my favorite. And I like, we were talking, Paul and I were talking earlier, the sequel came out a couple years ago, but I still liked Wings of Desire still. I want to see the sequel again. But it is just a remarkable film about angels brooding over Berlin. The great intuition of an artist, 2.5 years before the actual Berlin Wall fell, he does this film where the Berlin Wall is a symbol for the visible and invisible world, the conscious and unconscious. And these angels that brood, what they do, they can't really get into our life and make decisions for us, but what they can do, they just listen to our dialogue all day long, and they can get close, and they just feel our forlornness and our homesickness and our desire. And they just are a witness. Just get as close as they can without touching us. But this one angel wants to get healed. He longs to cross over from the invisible world to the visible world. And it's the film's a story about his falling in love with an acrobat in this world, the circus. And how he gets through the world by falling with all his angel's armor into the real visible world at the Berlin Wall. It's a wonderful symbol. You could use the creativity of artists to do this. But one of my favorite scenes I'm going to show you, and you'll see it, is that apparently, Peter Falk plays Peter Falk in the film, plays himself as, and he's an angel who's fallen through into the real world. And he keeps talking to this guy, I know you're around, I feel you guys. Feel you guys, just come on across. You look, there's nothing like the feel of a cup of hot coffee on a cold morning, stretching your feet out under a card table. It's a wonderful. But the scene I was going to show you was apparently angels have staff meetings like the rest of us. Apparently, in the visible world, they still are committee meetings, staff meetings. Still, but they're smart. They have their staff meetings, and it looks like a Mercedes-Benz dealership in the convertible. They do the staff meetings. But what their staff meetings are is sharing these poignant stories of the listening that they do every day. A man reads his son the most touching moments from the Odyssey, and his son blinks and a tear forms. 7:37. 8:58. An ordinarily sane conductor on the daily bullet train between Berlin and Paris suddenly screams at the back of the cage, "Last station stop, Tierra del Fuego, the end of the world, everybody off." This is this wonderful kind of data, but poignant things. So if you like a poignant film about the visible and invisible world, my favorite film is Wings of Desire. But I want to close with an image of a man who descends, is terrified, goes through all of the kind of Gnostic things, and I think has a transformative vision in the process of entering the invisible world. Is driven there by circumstance. It's a film, Peter Weir's The Last Wave, is his first film well-received in this continent. You'll see a much younger Richard Chamberlain playing the leading role as an attorney who's been assigned what we would call in the United States a pro bono case with Aborigines who have been involved in kind of death and mayhem in a tavern. And what happens is this young man and a sinister kind of, to him feeling sinister, older man, keep interpenetrating his dreams. And there's there's this stone with an ancient meander on it that shows up in his dream. And the faces of this man, who he comes to understand, is probably an aboriginal medicine man or a shaman. And he goes to an anthropologist who tells him about the aboriginal myths about these Urgu people, that are what we would call in our desert southwest the Anasazi. If you've ever gone to Mesa Verde or Havanweep, it's wonderful places. You know, those people, they call them the ancient ones, they disappeared. We don't know what happened to them. The Anasazi just disappeared. Well, it's apparently the same people, and they had a myth about a tidal wave that had came that the priests had predicted. But suddenly, this man doesn't know what's real and unreal, what's the visible world, what's the invisible world. And finally, reaches a point where he can't ignore it too much when he kind of comes home, and his family's terrified. He has to send him off to protection, and rain's fallen from the ceilings, and his house is filled with bull-roaring sounds. He suddenly decides that something needs to be done, and so he meets this young man, and the young man, the young Aboriginal man, has been dreaming of him. They kind of meet and finally decide to follow the destiny of the dream forward. And we're picking the film up there where he comes home. He's had a bad day, and it gets worse before it gets better. But I think it's a celebration of descending and ascending and facing the sorrow of his condition and ego surrendering to a transformative experience. And it seems like a good place to end the day before. We'll do a little bit. Oh! I really want you to see more of that. Put the right one in.
Thank you. through one man many times and any time when it seems good. But you will wait. And now, because of your dream and my need, I go to you. But I've broken the law of my people. Down there, past this snake, you will find what you're looking for. Go!
Thank you. What's that?
The second wind.
The second wind. And the whole process, what I like about that is you can, the whole model I've been presenting this weekend, there's clearly a discensive, a descendant, and there's clearly a contact, ego contacts the self, and then there's an ascensus, a kind of an ascending, kind of a double level kind of thing. We can spend a lot of time, but I think, just for a minute, how do you all feel after that kind of, like what your body sense after that, kind of check in for a disturbed audiences when it came out. Huh? Spin, yeah. Where was the self most vividly? Of course, the ego is carried by Richard Chamberlain. And it's an ego. And it's because one of those wonderful films where people debate for a long time how much was he in dream time and how much was he in real time. But where was the self most powerfully constellated there as a symbol? Well, it was the water. There was the water image. The sea again. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, the unconscious spilling. Is the ego. The ego was spilling with psychological. He could no longer keep back the unconscious. It was flooding into his world, storming in. Yeah, the kind of meander, the quaternal symbol of the cross inside the ancient. Probably that meander is the most ancient recurrent symbol that appears across synagogues, mosques, on rock walls the world over. It's probably the most powerful ancient symbol, the kind of spiral, the meander. What is another powerful image of the self?
Owl.
Oh, the owl. Yes, the owl appeared at the beginning. It's a kind of Athena's messenger, she's, you know, the part of us that sees in the unconscious in the dark. Oh, absolutely. I think that was the car. That was what a wonderful scene. He has the light on it. You know, one of the Gnostic themes is this doubling, that the self doubles the ego. And we often they talk about the twin in Gnostic myth. That the ego has its twin in the unconscious. That the visible person has its twin in the unconscious. I think he met the self. And it's wonderful. Ego that's so much in the light is in the dark. You just barely see it. Because he's absolutely enchanted and fascinated with the image of the self. He goes to the depth of his, not only individual, but clearly his collective experience. He goes to the Mulkru. He goes to the Anasazi. He goes to the ancient ones, to the ancient ancestors, to the bottom of the unconscious, and finds his own, an image of his own true self there. Yeah, 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 yeah. It's terrifying. And it's there. It's very close. Then we don't know exactly all what happens, but it's almost like he meets his dream mother in this world, and what ego does? What is ego? He has his trans, and then he pops right back into Chronos consciousness. What's he do? Let's take it with him. You know, the minute we get to the self, let's grab it. Let's loot the tomb of our unconscious. You know,
that's the frightening part.
He's kind of, there's kind of an awe in him. It's kind of almost a Stonehenge quality, and we see the owl. And if you don't, you hear pneuma, the pneumatic elements, the wind. And then you hear the flutter of the spirit birds, bats, or eagles, or owls, you don't know what it is. And then he has this profound moment that consciousness can't. He pops right back. The first thing you want to do when you visit him is strip mine the unconscious, you know, grab bag it, take as much. God, I ought to get a lot of this at an antique store, you know. Take it back to the fallen city, the fallen Jerusalem. And, of course, that's when the ancestral defenders come. And very close on that, he commits what looks like an act of assault and maybe even murder. We're not given information. She's hand going, you hear a boom, knocks it over in a thud. He encounters the ancestral presence with a kind of a bad taint, but he still carries his bag. What happens to the bag of goodies? You lose. You can never steal the stuff of the unconscious and get it back into the above realm. Well, you can't do that. It belongs to the unconscious. You can't take it with you. And what's the suffering that he pays for that crime? The crime against the ancestral presence and against the artifacts. What's the suffering he paid? Well, he's swamped and he comes up there and he discovers that it's a one-way door. There's no handle on it.
I thought that one, you couldn't go back to the old way.
Can't. And what happens to ego at that moment? What are the two kind of primordial emotions that ego, that this talented, aggressive, effective attorney, above world attorney, what's he have to do?
Give up.
He just collapses. He collapses into sorrow and panic and exhaustion and fatigue. And you see him drop on the door. He slinks down the steps and he goes back in the unconscious. And he finds another way out. But he's a much more defeated person. And he goes, it's almost a baptismal moment. He falls in the sea. He's going to open himself up for the tidal wave of the deep unconscious. My guess is he'll be a transformed man after that wave. If he's not swept away, he can hold. This time he won't try to steal the unconscious. But it's a wonderful set of, it plays with all of the images of ascending and descending, the twinning, the alienation of this world, the cutoff that we, Sardello's, all three categories of Eros, the Gnostics said we're trying to reclaim, cut off from the, our cities are cut off from the land, they're cut off from the ancestors, and they're cut off from the archetypal. And this aboriginal person that enters his dream and he enters the aboriginal dream reintroduces him to the ancestors, to the deep wombic earth and to the archetypal power, and teaches them about ways to try and hold on to it. Just a quick summary, and then I'll give you some bibliography, and we're at the end of the day, but my vision of what I think key themes that we've been messing with. All of us have been primarily wounded by life, by environmental, genetic, and existential spiritual trauma. All of us have varying wounds. Some of us have got the bad cholesterol and are going to die a lot earlier than the rest of them. I said, ain't fair, but that's a genetic wounding. We all have environmental wounds. Some of us have breathed in more asbestos than others, and it's not fair, and it was just an accident of exposure. And we've all been psychospiritually wounded. There's trauma. All of us have split off this wound and buried it in the unconscious. Under this toxic, organic, unconscious wound in all of us is the Imago Dei, the living splinter of the Divine One's ongoing salvific, healing presence in our life, what Jung called the self. The self is often experienced in dreams and active imaginations as the divine child archetype, the child of God's timeless love, living and breathing and hoping in our flesh, who co-endeared that original trauma with us and eternally whispers into the ears of our soul God's ongoing promises of love and transformation. Individuation is the Jungian description of that lifelong transformation and sanctification process, that dynamic of remembering the buried trauma and reframing it in the light of God's eternally living and healing grace. And I think the Gnostics believe that. Individuation works via archetypal sequences of consciously received and digested image. Images Jung suggestively shorthanded as shadow, anima, animus, mandala, quaternity, spirit, and of course self. And we saw all those images. The doubling of male and female, the shadow selves that have to be met, quaternal images, round mandala, protective mandala images, spirit images, owl images. Jung's teachers in this process were the ancient non-dualist alchemists, Gnostics, and mystics of the Judeo-Christian Western tradition, salvaged alive from the soul wreckage of his patients in his own life. And I think that cinema, at least in its narrative fiction forms, been what I've been working with the last couple of days, is the living theological exploration of that process in our time and culture. It is the living repository, the user-friendly library, if you will, of animated image by which we can potentially recover the living presence of the divine or self in our being. That's what I've been talking about. I think the film is and hopefully suggestive enough for you to, next time that you go to even a sex and violent film on Friday night, if you can hold it into consciousness, to think about some of the individuating metaphors. Some books, people always want to know about some bibliography, and make sure it's the right file. Yeah. And again, I'll send if you want this in detail, just can look at it. Unfortunately, not a lot really exists that's good about psychotherapy and spirituality in film yet. I would like to see a lot more, but some books that I found that I like. Arthur Gibson's got a really nice book called Silence of God, Creative Response to the Films of Ingmar Bergman, if you like them. John Beebe is a really nice cassette. The closest to John, other than he writes frequently in the San Francisco Library Journal about film. But Film and the Unconscious is a lecture he gave at the Los Angeles Jung Institute. It's available through the Los Angeles bookstore. It's a very nice tape. Clark Branson, who is not a Jungian, I don't know who he is, actually, wrote a book called Howard Hawks, A Jungian Study. It's roughly edited and kind of theoretically naive, because I don't think he's an analyst. I don't know. You get the feeling that how much he's even experienced Jungian thought from a deeper level. But it's an introductory look at trying to mate Jungian concepts to thought, and he uses Howard Hawks. So, you know, the French New Wave directors, François Truffaut and all these people that did the Cahiers de Cinéma, the famous journal about film theory in the 60s and 70s and started the New Wave, the two directors they loved the most, they rediscovered the art of John Ford and Howard Hawks in the Westerns. They loved John Ford's The Searchers, and they loved Howard Hawks' films as archetypal directors that really were dealing with profoundly deep stuff. And he looks at Howard Hawks' film, building on the French's awareness of the artistry of these guys. Barbara Krieg is an Australian feminist that has a wonderful little book I like called A Monstrous Feminine, Film, Feminism, and Psychoanalysis, that's really provocative. They use a kind of a Lacanian analysis. Christian Metz and Jacques Lacan are kind of theorists that a lot of people interested in psychoanalysis go to. We don't have very many Americans that have spent a lot of time reflecting on depth issues. And that's pretty Freudian. I'd like to see some Jungians kind of look at some Jungian things. But it's a nice volume. Daniel Dervin's got a book called Through a Freudian Lens Deeply, A Psychoanalysis of Film. It's a nice readable text, but again, Freudian. Robert Evervine, I did that first quote last night, Film and the Dream Screen. It's a fun little volume that I like. There was a psychiatrist, Harvey Greenberg, did a thing called Movies on Your Mind that's kind of a breezy, popular confection. A really nice filmography, you know that really nice volume Louise Mahdi did on Betwixt and Between? I don't know if any of you have seen it. It's a collection of Jungian analysts have written about life cycle individuation. There's a nice essay in there by Robert Hinkle called Transition Films, a Selected Filmography, about it, how film has reflected male and female initiation themes. And it's a nice, it's dated, 87, but it's a nice collection. Jung hated film. The Psyche, where he talks about art. Volume 15 is a must, The Spirit in Man, Art and Literature. They're classical, but there's some really nice looks at. But it's primarily the visual arts and literature and mystical stuff. He doesn't do much with moving image. Annette Kuhn has a nice thing on women in film, which is a concise look at the feminist contributions. Women have been deeply involved in film in secondary and hidden roles ever since the industry got started 100 years ago, and she does a nice job of lifting the presence of women. Peter Malone has got a book that's okay on movie Christ and Antichrist. It's not one of my favorites, but I really like Thomas Martin's book, Images and the Imageless, A Study in Religious Consciousness in the Film. It's about 14 years old now, but it's a great read if you want to see somebody take images and look at them from spiritual reflections. Christian Metz, The Psychoanalysis in Cinema, The Imaginary Signifier, that's the key text if you're interested in relating psychoanalysis and psychological thought to film. It's a very difficult, very deep. It's into a kind of French fascination with semantics, signifiers, and signs and symbols, and kind of Lacanian psychoanalysis. But it's worth it if you're interested in that. It's a complete read. Paul Monaco, Ribbons and Time. It's a really nice look at social history and theory of film. Psychological Perspectives, which Ernie Rossi now is editing. It's the LA Center's organs. It has some great film reflections in it. San Francisco Library Journal does too. John Beebe does that for the San Francisco Institute. Paul Schrader, I gave you an outline. He's the guy that wrote the script for Taxi Driver and The Last Temptation of Christ, and has directed some of his own films. Transcendental Style and Film. It's a great brief look at Bresson, Dreyer, and Otsu. And of course, for those of you, I doubt that's true of anybody in this group, but if you're new to Jungian thought, I still think June's Boundaries of the Soul, June Singer's, the best single volume look at Jungian kind of concepts out. If you want some theological reflection on today, a journal, Theology Today, has a lot of good kind of religious essays on film. And a classic, I still love Kandinsky's Concerning the Spiritual, a brief little text. I mean, I think he wrote this at the beginning. It's 1964, but I think he wrote it to the beginning, the middle part of the century. It's a wonderful read about looking at beauty from a spiritual perspective. And I think it's a classic, regardless of how you enter. And as far as Gnosticism and psychotherapy and mysticism, these are some of my favorite, outside of Hollers, which is anything of Hollers. Stefan Hollers' books in Gnosticism are just, he had a super collection on here. I just really liked it. And June Singer's own little
volume on a Gnostic Book a Day. Robert Avens, through Spring Publications, kind of looking at Gnosticism in contemporary forms. It's some really provocative essays. If you like, you're interested in the recovery of eroticism, Rita Nakashima Brock has a Christology of erotic power. She writes as a feminist about the recovery of eros in our civilization. It's wonderful. Aldo Caratanuto is an analyst that writes Eros and Pathos, Shades of Love and Suffering, which kind of looks at the light and dark sides of erotic material. Henry Corbin's essay on the Mundus Imaginalis, or the imaginary and the imaginal, is a key essay on looking at the imaginal inside cultural context. And I think it's a great beat. I really like Plato because we really are Platonist as Jungians. Hillman's Anima is a nice volume. This, Lawrence Joffe's Liberating the Heart, if you've not found it, I think is the best volume written by an analyst in the last 10 years about Jungian spirituality. He also likes Edinger a lot, but it's a wonderful little volume. It's in the Inner City series. Thomas More, of course, we've all found on Care of the Soul and Soulmates are two companion volumes that are wonderful. Jeanette Paris, great read on Eros. Pagan Grace, Dionysius, Hermes, and the Goddess of Memory in Daily Life. It's wonderful if you like that erotic. And Robert Sardello, I've been quoting from Facing the World with Soul. If you're interested in the Gnostic tradition across, how it's still alive and has lived across the centuries from the beginning of the Judeo-Christian era through the Cathars, the modern times, Margaret Starbird, The Woman with the Alabaster Jar, Mary Magdalene and the Holy Grail is an interesting read. Looks at the paintings of Botticelli. It's a fascinating brief volume. She's a Northwest artist. And an analyst, if you like the incest theme that I've been talking about, Robert Stein's Incest and Human Love, classic text. Kind of cuts close to that. But and again, I say, well, all the volumes of Stefan Holler are wonderful, and June Singer's little volume on the Gnostic Book of Days. But some reading, and I'll send Xeroxes of those along. And we're 10 minutes over. You've been a good bunch.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.